Welcome to this audio recording by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to promoting public awareness of global issues and the ways in which they affect the Dallas-Fort Worth region. Become a member today at dfwworld.org and help us connect North Texas with the world. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
Thank you, David. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. First, let me thank my hosts, the Bilateral Arab-U.S. or U.S.-Arab Chamber of Commerce and the World Affairs Council. Both of them have been wonderful in organizing this very intensive and fruitful visit. It's a whirlwind tour of two cities, which has not given me a chance really to savor the true character of Texas. I still haven't noticed any big hats or cowboy boots. But here we are. I am on a mission, and I have no time to waste because I come with a message. This message is important for my country, and I do sincerely believe that it is very important for this country also. The world is changing, yes, every day. Survival depends on adaptation. This country, like the rest of the world, has to adapt. Iraq is a particular focal point. Indeed, it's the front line of a historical struggle between two ways of life, two ideologies, two cultures, two sets of values. One set of value you are all familiar with: the rule of law, respect for human beings, human rights, the dignity of life, the sanctity of life, participatory politics, and sense of fairness and justice. The other set of values include despotism, tyranny, the assumption of right to monopolize wealth and power. These two sets of values are engaged in a historic struggle, and the front line passes through Iraq. This battle is not fought as the Second World War was, by battalions and trenches and thousands of people in uniform. It's fought in the hearts of minds of nations. It's fought by a lot of people in civilian clothes, prepared to kill others, prepared to kill innocent civilians. By a lot of people in civilian clothes thinking that it is right to kill themselves and convert themselves into a weapon of mass destruction. That struggle visited this country on 9/11. It is visiting us in Iraq every day. We are losing people every day to this struggle. But I submit to you that this is a struggle that neither you nor we can afford to lose. To lose this battle in Iraq would carry consequences far beyond Iraq. They would influence you here in this city and your children and your children's children. So let's see what this battle in Iraq is all about and how it is going and what the prospects are. I'll try to be brief. Iraq left us with Saddam left us with a very heavy legacy. I was born in Baghdad, as David said. I was brought up in Baghdad. And Baghdad was a very gentle city, a prosperous city. People were tending their gardens, looking after their children, educating them. Iraq had a GDP equivalent to that of Spain in the 50s. When Saddam took over power, Iraq had a reserve of more than $35 billion and was well on the way of constructing a secular democratic state. Women enjoyed a very advanced position. First woman graduate in Iraq was a law graduate in 1935. It's a long time before some of our neighbors even started sending their daughters to primary schools. We had pioneers in the arts, in literature, and in many walks of life. Architects were the finest. Zaha Habib is one of the Iraqi architects who still enjoys world fame. Saddam then came after a series of military coups. And when he left, Iraq was on its knees. Instead of a surplus or a reserve, we were in debt to the tune of something like $350 billion, including war reparations. The Iraqi dinar, which was worth 3.3 American dollars, was completely obliterated. $1 became equal to more than 3,000 Iraqi dinars. And I can go on and on and on. We had a whole generation. In fact, the majority of the population of Iraq is composed of people who were born and brought up under the rule of Saddam. Most of them had seen nothing but wars and destruction. There was no employment but to be employed by security forces. They've seen, they have no skills except how to wield a weapon and how to kill. The whole population was brutalized and traumatized and criminalized in the sense that criminality became common, corruption became common and widespread, and a primitive struggle for survival dominated people's lives. However, Iraq is also the place where a lot of the values that you enjoy here originated. It is the cradle of civilization. It's the place where, contrary to many people's belief, democracy was born. It was not the Greeks who were the first to define democracy. It was in Sumer, 3,500 BC, that democracy was born. This is well documented. I don't want to go on about this. But many of the real values, the first laws ever, the first constitution was written in Iraq. Iraq is a place where writing itself was invented. So we bequeathed upon humanity a great deal of what humanity enjoys today. But we were pushed back. And after Saddam was removed, we had and we have to reconstruct our civilization with help from our friends. But we have not been left alone to do that. We are facing challenges mounted against us by international terrorists, by the remnants of Saddam's regime, and I don't want to belittle their power or influence because they are very powerful. They are well-financed, well-funded, well-motivated because they want to regain control over the country and dominate its wealth and exploit it. They work like a mafia. They forged alliances with international terrorists and extremist groups, Al-Qaeda. And we are facing challenges by organized crime, by corruption, and by the peddling of influence by some of our neighbors. It's a formidable array of adversaries. But we have no intention of buckling under this challenge. Iraqis have demonstrated to the world that they are capable of standing up and making clear to the world that their choice is the choice of democracy. Lines of voters challenged the terrorists, determined to cast their votes even under threat. Some lines were attacked and people died, yet the remaining people in those lines continued to cast their votes. That sends a message to the world that this is what Iraq wants. That's what the Iraqi people want. Now, with these challenges, with these risks, every day we have hundreds of victims, thousands of victims every month. But more than the number of victims is the number of heroes, ordinary people, determined to get on with their lives, determined to ensure that the terrorists will not win the day. Now I want to transport you back to where we are now in this country. There is a lively debate, an intensive debate, about what to do about Iraq. Iraq has turned out to be a more complex situation than most people anticipated. Americans are losing more and more people and money. It looks like an open commitment. I believe that the American people generally are a reasonable people, are people who don't like to lose. If the facts, the true facts, the true picture is presented to them in an unbiased and in a clear way, they will stand with on the right side. Unfortunately, all we have seen in the media, on television screen, is death and destruction. The stories of heroism, the stories of progress, have not had a fair share. We have more than half the country, which is reasonably stable. In some areas, there is a construction boom. People are building cities and building industries and building universities. In Kurdistan now, an American university is going to be built. There was one university and now there are four, and the fifth is being built. In the rest of Iraq, in many areas, we are building up our ports, our airports, and our roads, and we are making progress despite these challenges. This is really, if you think about it, amazing. In many countries, people are overjoyed when more than 40%, 50% people turn out to vote. In Iraq, it was more than 70%. Under these conditions where people lack electricity, power, water, clean water to drink, yet they go on and they mark up every day significant progress on every front. But what are the consequences of the United States deciding to turn around and walk away? The consequences would be dire for us, but they would also be dire for the United States. I believe any responsible American government cannot take such a decision lightly. And I believe this is an issue which must be raised above party politics. Democrats and Republicans alike will, I'm sure, look at this from the perspective of the American national interest, and they will come to very similar solutions. There is another thing. There are some ideas being presented as easy solutions, silver bullet. Divide Iraq into three parts, and that would solve the problem. It's not so simple. If there was such a simple solution, we would have found it already. We had to negotiate very hard between us. I had the honor of participating in the writing of the provisional constitution, the transitional administrative law, and I took part in very, very tough negotiations. I was on the side of the secularists, and we had the Islamists, the Kurds. We fought over every sentence, every word. But at the end of the day, we all had to give concessions and agree between us what could be agreed and what all of us were prepared to live with. That's how democracy works. We are learning how to do it, but we are learning fast, and we are doing it. I'm sure had any of you been present at those negotiations, you would have been amazed. We were told by some of our American friends that what they witnessed then was something very significant, was something historical. We were writing the modern history of Iraq in ways that would honor us in the eyes of our descendants. We are continuing to build. And these choices which we incorporated in our constitution are finely balanced and are hard won. We don't like the idea of somebody from outside coming and imposing a solution upon us. We will arrive at our own solution given the opportunity and given the time. We have been pushed to achieve results within time frames which were more geared to suit the American political calendar than our own reality. That's not right. We need time to complete our course. I've said that a baby cannot be delivered in less than 9 months. If you try to force that, you create more harm than good. We need the time to complete what we have started, the road towards democracy and freedom. We're doing it despite all the challenges, despite the terrorism, despite the deaths, despite the massacres which are perpetrated against us. But in this process, we need our friends who share the responsibility, because it was the American intervention which opened the gates for us. And we are grateful for that. But having created this situation, the Americans have a responsibility also. And it's important that we stay together and we complete what we have started. To do so will bring great benefits, not only to Iraq, but also to the region. The reconstruction of Iraq will become the engine of growth for the region. It will be a source of stability for the region. We have incorporated in our new constitution clauses which forbid any pursuit of weapons of mass destruction, which would forbid any future government from waging war on our neighbors. We want to build a democratic, a free, peaceful country, which will be a power for good, which would reinstate our country which was the cradle of civilization, to be an active participant in modern civilization. We have the people to do it. We have the guts to do it. We need you to stand with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Excellency. You can see by the standing ovation what respect we have for you and the work that you are doing and the sacrifices that you and your family are making. I would like to welcome students that are in the audience. And if I could ask the students to stand, they're here from Hockaday, Berkner High School, Pierce High School, Plano East Senior High, Brookhaven Junior College, UTD, and UNT. Students, thank you all for being here. And as is our tradition, we were at KERA this morning, and the moderator said something very good. For questions, we're going to follow the three C's. We're going to be civil, we're going to be concise, and what was the third? Civil, concise? Calm, that's right. And I know that our audience can do that. But first, Travis, where is Travis? You have the microphone. So if you'd raise your hands, who would like to ask a question? Now, that's not possible. There we go. All right. But first, we're going to have a question by a student. And this is Leslie Johnson and Marta from Hockaday. In your opinion, Your Excellency, will women ever have equal status with men in Iraq?
They sure will. I would be in trouble if I said otherwise. We made good progress on this. We made sure that this is enshrined in our new constitution. We wrote into the constitution a guarantee that women will have at least 25% of the membership of our parliament, and they are now nearly 30%. A very determined lot. I believe personally that women are a tremendous force for peace, for stability. They care about their communities. They are an insurance against violence. During Saddam, women were very mistreated. In Saddam's time, torture of women, indeed, rape, was used in an institutional manner. There were people employed by the security forces as rapists, and they did that, and they used it as a political weapon. These atrocities are a thing of the past. Now we have to care about our women, help them to be educated, get them to work with us side by side. This is where the future of Iraq lies.
You were talking about how, you know, the wonderful ancient civilization. Was the Great Library of Baghdad burned in the invasion as well as being looted?
Yes, we lost a great deal in recent years. And after the military intervention in particular, unfortunately, there was a period of looting and lawlessness. And tragically, the Iraqi museum was looted. Iraq, you can think of Iraq as a big museum. There are more than 80,000 archaeological sites in Iraq. A lot has been lost. In fact, it's estimated that more than 15,000 artifacts were lost from the Iraqi museum. We have retrieved about half of those, and we are pursuing the rest through Interpol and so on. But what's more dangerous and more serious is the loss of artifacts from archaeological sites, because those have not been cataloged and photographed yet. And when they are stolen and taken out of the country, they lose context because we don't know where they were found, and that information is lost forever. And this is not the property of only Iraq. It's the property of humanity. This is important for the human race as a whole. So, yes, there has been some tragic loss. We're trying our best to retrieve what we can, and we've had a lot of help from the United States in doing this and from other countries, and we will do our best to safeguard what we have. Thank you.
Russian Dallas newspaper. Do you know by any chance what kind of friendship Iraq has with Russia at the moment? Thank you.
Well, you know, Iraq needs all the friends it can get. There were countries who were, during Saddam's time, supportive of Saddam. And there were, even, let's be quite candid and honest, even the United States supported Saddam at one point. But bygones are bygones. And we take the attitude now that we would like to be friends with the whole of the world. Russia is a very important country, and it's a country which has legitimate interests, like other countries in the region and in Iraq. I took part in high-level visits. We went to the Kremlin. We talked to President Putin, both in the Kremlin and in the United Nations. And the message we always carry is that we want to build a new relationship based on mutual interests. We are appreciative of Russia's attitude in the debt issue. They have fallen in line with the forgiveness of debt, as in the Paris Club. So yes, Russia is important, as is China, as are many other countries, and we want to build a positive, mutually beneficial relationship with all.
Could I see a show of hands for questions so we can get a better view? Your Excellency, you really didn't talk that much in your remarks about Iran. I wonder if you could talk about the relationship between Iraq and Iran. And Travis, we have some questions.
Yes. Iran, you know, you can choose your friends, but you cannot choose your family. We can choose our friends, but we cannot choose our neighbors. We cannot change geography. Iran is our neighbor. We also share with them a lot of cultural and historical traditions. However, Iran now is, as you know, a theocracy, and it is also engaged in a kind of confrontation with the United States because of their ambitions in the nuclear field. Our position, we are against the development of any nuclear weapons in the area. We are for a nuclear-free Middle East. And we would be extremely uncomfortable, indeed threatened, if we felt that any of our neighbors has nuclear weapons. However, Iran has some influence on politics in Iraq for various reasons, and I don't want to go into that. And as the confrontation with the United States is escalated, they are tempted to tweak the situation in Iraq to make life more uncomfortable for the United States. And as a result, we pay the price in Iraq. It is in our interest to reduce the tension, to de-escalate rather than to escalate. That was the message which our President Talabani carried to President Bush when he met him in New York recently, and I was there in the meeting. We believe that it would be better to engage the Iranians, because Iran is not a single power. There are many sides within Iran. And we enter into dialogue. And again, I visited Tehran and I met with all the top leaders. unfortunately, they have a declared policy and they have another policy at the practical level. And it's hard to really know exactly what they are going to do simply by sitting and talking to them. We believe that it is better to engage Iran, to try and resolve these issues through dialogue, to de-escalate, and allow us in Iraq time to get more stabilized and more secure. Thank you.
Question back there.
You mentioned the process of developing the Constitution. What, if any, concessions were made to the Kurdish North to not break away from Iraq proper?
We were active in the opposition movement, opposition to Saddam, for many, many years, and we worked closely with our Kurdish comrades and colleagues. And back in the in 92, we held a conference in Salah ad-Din, in the liberated area of Iraq, in north of Iraq. And we agreed at that time that, first, the principle of self-determination. If the Kurds wanted to secede, they have the right to do so. Any unity has to be built on consent, on a free choice. That principle was conceded by all political leaders in Iraq, and we stick to that. Now, we also agreed at that time that the best structure for Iraq is a federal structure, which allows regions to conduct their own affairs in the way they wish. We still believe in that, and that's how the Constitution is written. Now, I believe the Kurds understand that they have a much better future in a prosperous Iraq than they would have in an independent statelet of Kurdistan. There's more wealth to be shared, there's a bigger market to be shared, and they know very well that the Kurds of Iraq have done a lot better for themselves than the Kurds of Turkey, the Kurds of Iran, and the Kurds in Syria, where they hardly have the right to acknowledge or declare their nationality. They are well respected. They are installed in government, in central government. Our president is a Kurd now. My boss, the foreign minister, is a Kurd. So they have nothing to complain about by being inside Iraq. The choice is theirs, and we would respect it. But we would rather be in the same family together out of choice than by force. Thank you.
I'd like to follow up on the Iran issue, specifically with regards to a nuclear-armed Iran. With facing the prospect of a nuclear-armed Iran, how would Iraq protect itself from such a threat by a neighbor next door?
In the same way as pacifist Japan is likely to protect itself against North Korea.
We have another question from a student, Hannah Gandhi, a 12th senior at Pierce High School. Do you think that support from Iraqis for the insurgency will continue to rise, and do you believe that the U.S. troop presence provokes more violence than it prevents?
No to both. The insurgency is raging, yes. But to understand it properly, you have to break it down to its components. And a significant part of its components is economically based. The extremist element, the Qaeda-inspired part, is being more and more isolated and alienated from the population. It's getting less and less support, not more and more support. People who boycotted the first election participated in the later election. People who were outside the political process came into the political process. Tribes in Al-Anbar province, from where my ancestors come, have now banded together to fight off Al-Qaeda and Islamist extremists. We are making progress in isolating the extremists. However, this overlaps with as I said, organized crime, Saddamists trying to regain power. And there's a lot of money in smuggling and kidnapping and looting of banks and so on. And it sometimes, looking at it from the outside, it's hard to decipher what's going on, which is which. But the insurgency in general, as defined by people who are committed to be against the new order on ideological basis, if we define it in that sense, it is not gaining power. And in terms of the presence of the American forces in Iraq, you know, you can ask people, and people might be disenchanted with the American forces, who are more trained to fight battles than police neighborhoods. But at the end of the day, this kind of decision is taken by sovereign parliament, by politicians who have to weigh up the choices and decide what is in the interest of the country. And clearly, the consensus now is that what is in the interest of Iraq is that the American forces and the multinational forces continue to fill the security vacuum and allow us time to get on our feet and build up our security forces to the level of power that we can take up the slack. That is what matters in Iraq, and that's where we stand.
Tony, I think we have some questions in the back. And Travis, you have the microphone there. Back on that side, Tony. If you raise your hand so Tony can see you, and then he'll come to you. Thank you. Travis?
Your Excellency, I wonder if you could comment what the connection, if ever there was, between Iraq and 9/11.
I might not be able to give you a plotted direct link, but as I said in my remarks, the connection is clear because it's the same ideology and mentality that visited the United States on 9/11, which is now fighting us and you together in Iraq. It's the same enemy manifested in different ways. On 9/11, it used aircraft as weapons. Now it is using suicide bombers in the streets of Baghdad and attacking convoys of Americans. It's the same enemy. Iraq has faced about 900 suicide bombers in the last 3 years. You can imagine any country in the world which can sustain this vicious onslaught. It's incredible. Yet, it has happened. But it's the same enemy. Make no mistake about it.
You were standing next to me. Go ahead.
As you travel around the United States, how do you find the reception and the attitudes of the typical American people towards you personally and towards your country? And the second question I had was, where were you and what were you actually doing when Saddam was in power?
The first question is that wherever I go in the United States, what I find is overwhelming goodwill, warmth, and support, and a willingness to understand. It is very heartening, what I find. And I will continue to try and communicate with the American public through whatever means I have to convey the same message that I have conveyed to you today. There are a lot of people who are confused because they are not well informed. And it's hard to be well informed, frankly. It's understandable. But I have great respect for the American public in terms of their sentiments and values. As for the second question, I was in exile based in London, but I was extremely active in the opposition movement. I participated in every conference, every meeting that I could. But I was working as a designer and as a businessman, and I had to bring up a family, and you know, I had to get on with my life. And at one point, our task looked hopeless. I used to come to the United Nations as a lobbyist and try to meet ambassadors from various countries, and it was hard to get people to listen to us. And it was strange when I then was posted to the United Nations as an ambassador and was on the other side. But I was involved and I was engaged, and I had to tell my family in Iraq to disown me because of the dangers that might flow from my activities. But that's where I was.
Could you please tell me how much longer you believe it'll take to stabilize Iraq, and what is being done to bring those with ideological differences into the fold?
It's hard to give a prediction because some of the factors which will influence the length of time and speed of progress are out of our control, or at least out of control of the Iraqi side. I gave an example moments ago about Iran as a player. The way this confrontation with Iran goes will have either an accelerating or a retarding impact on the process in Iraq. And there are some other factors. We have our brothers, the Syrians. We have other factors which we cannot influence. But there are also factors which we can influence, and we are working on those as fast as we can. It is really hard to predict. As we adapt and change our tactics, we are facing an adversary who is also resourceful and quite intelligent. And they are adapting, and they are using new tactics, vicious tactics of intimidation and terror. The one thing that is very clear in my mind is that no matter how long it takes, and of course it's in our interest to shorten the agony, but no matter how long it takes, we've got to win this. There is no way to contemplate losing it.
We'll take two more questions.
Mr. Ambassador, again, thank you for being here. But one of the distinct impressions we have here in the U.S. is that Iraq has slipped or is slipping into civil war. And I wonder if you could comment on that. And also, independent of the insurgency, which is a complication for you, that your political parties also have independent militias, which are complicating the situation from a security perspective, both in the military and the police. And I wonder if you could kind of talk about that subject generally, because I think the notion of the civil war, I think, is that's our impression here.
Yes, this is a question I get quite often, and I think I should clarify this. According to my understanding, you have a civil war when you have communities fighting each other. In Iraq, there is no such phenomenon. The communities are not fighting each other. There are extremists from one community attacking the other community, and extremists from the other community attacking this community. The communities are not at war. I was in Lebanon when the civil war started in Lebanon in 1975, and I saw the situation. It was really an all-out war between communities. We don't have that. Iraqi society, for thousands of years has never been a homogeneous society. It has always been multi-ethnic, multi-confessional. And we are used to live with each other. And there are mixed marriages. There are some tribes which are half Sunni, half Shia. So what we are witnessing in Iraq is sectarian violence, yes. Started and instigated by Al-Qaeda, because one of their declared tactics was to start a civil war. In fact, the amazing thing is that they failed. Despite all their provocations, they managed to get some reactions and retributions, but they managed to activate the opposite extremists. But they have not managed to get the bulk of the people to fight each other. And there are many stories. You know, we hear every day stories about people who are killed. And I lost some of my cousins to sectarian violence. But we have a lot more stories of people protecting their neighbors, although they are different from them. So I believe what we have is a society which is very resistant to the idea of a civil war. Now, about militias, again, I come back to the Constitution. We have enshrined in the Constitution the principle of making militias unlawful, of inadmissibility of militias. The Prime Minister has declared his clear intention to disband militias. But militias, we cannot just order them to be disbanded and they get disbanded. We have to tackle this problem in many different ways. We have to find employments for the young people. We have to understand why militias were started, because there was a security vacuum. And many people wanted to protect themselves by forming militias. And some of the militias are funded by some of our neighbors. And so we have to adopt several approaches, political, economic, and security approaches. We'll get there. It's the declared policy of the government. It's the intention of this government. But remember, this is the first government which has been elected with a reasonably long mandate, 4 years. All the previous governments have been transitional governments with a lifespan of 6 months to 9 months. And they had no time to get into the swing of their program. And now we have a real chance. And the intention is very clear. And I believe it will be done, but it will take time.
Last question, Travis.
Your Excellency, do you feel that your views of secularism are shared by the majority of Iraq, or do you feel that they're being pushed upon the citizens of a nation that have been primarily Muslim at its core, although a lot of the values have been corrupted by the past government?
I cannot stand here and tell you that the majority of Iraq is secularist. But I can tell you that Iraq was predominantly a secular state, the Iraq that I grew up in. But Iraq regressed during Saddam's time. And because he obliterated all opposition, the only thing that he could not obliterate was the mosque, because it's part of, you know, society's fundamental culture. He tried to co-opt religion to serve the regime. He incorporated the word Allahu Akbar in the flag, and he co-opted a lot of the clergymen to serve. And as a result, there was a resurgence of religion in Iraq, and the only people who were allowed to organize were Islamists. As a result, when Saddam was removed, the only political structures were Islamist and not secular. Now, this change, I believe, is reversible. It is for a period of time, but we have reached an accommodation with the Islamists. When we were debating the principles of our constitution, the Islamists insisted on incorporating a clause which says no law will be promulgated in Iraq which contravenes the basic tenets or principles of Islam. But we, on the other hand, insisted on saying that we insisted on a clause which says, no law shall be promulgated which contravenes the principles of democracy. So there is a balance. This balance is necessary and it's understandable. And as society will evolve, it will find its own adjustment. Europe did not become secularist in a year or a decade. It took centuries. We will take our time. But ultimately, the future of Iraq is going to be that way. Thank you very much.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.